From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Number one at the box office this weekend, Michael Moore's new movie, Fahrenheit 9/11, is generating a heated storm of controversy across the country. Call it polemical, call it propaganda, call it an impassioned political argument. The film and its record-breaking opening are creating a firestorm of political debate in an already contentious election year. Tonight, On Point, the facts and the fury over Fahrenheit 9/11. But first we go to Washington, where tomorrow the Army plans to announce an involuntary mobilization of thousands of reserve troops for deployment in Iraq and Afghanistan. Mark Mazzetti is defense correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. I asked him how many soldiers will be notified about possible deployment.
Well, the Army's going to make an official announcement tomorrow, but they've said that it's anywhere between about 5,500 to 6,500 soldiers of this pool known as the Individual Ready Reserve, which is basically a pool of inactive soldiers, former soldiers, who many of them had been discharged already but still have some degree of obligation left in their contract with the Pentagon.
So they're going to be notified to be ready for call-up, but how many of them will actually be called up?
That still remains to be seen. What they're going to do is the Pentagon's going to call these people up or notify them and then basically figure out how many of these people they're going to need. I was told yesterday by an Army official it may be as few as about a third, so maybe about 2,000 might actually be needed for service in Iraq or Afghanistan, which would be units that deploy this fall and early next year, the next rotation in those countries.
Tell us a little bit more about the individual ready reserve, and how often is it called upon?
Well, it's something you don't hear very much about, in part because they don't get called up all that often. The last time they were actually called up in any large number was Operation Desert Storm, which was 1991. And that was the last time the Army needed them. And again, this was to fill key spots, you know, holes that were not filled in select active and reserve units. There have been some that have served since 9/11, but most of those were on a voluntary basis. What's significant about the Army's expected announcement tomorrow is that these will all be involuntary announcements and mobilizations.
Are there any members of the individual ready reserve already serving in Iraq?
Yes, there are. And it could be up to several thousand. It was unclear yesterday exactly the exact number. But again, this was mostly on a voluntary basis. So they are now dipping into the involuntary pool of individual ready reservists who, again, are no longer active soldiers, but they do have some degree of commitment left on their contract to the Pentagon.
And these reservists will be deployed, do we know, in Iraq, in Afghanistan?
Yeah, the ones that actually do get assigned to units most likely will be going to one of those two countries. The broader issue is that the Army really is scratching to get enough troops to fulfill these obligations, you know, very large obligations to both countries. And as they plan to deploy troops, they really have to look months and years into the future to prepare them. So what they're doing is they're notifying them now several months early so they can find out not only how many they need, but to give those soldiers some time to prepare to deploy.
It might strike many people as surprising that the Pentagon is doing this with the handover of sovereignty in Iraq and maybe amongst a lot of people an expectation of a lessening of the U.S. military burden there.
Yeah, that's right. The U.S. government in Iraq has dissolved, but its army has been left behind and will be staying there for months, if not years, into the future. There is not one fewer soldier or marine in Iraq today than there was yesterday. So, as I said, the Pentagon has to continue preparing to deploy troops on rotations well into the future. And as has been widely reported, they're pretty stretched right now looking for troops. So there has been not only hundreds of thousands of reservists called up since 9/11, but there have been also these things called stop-loss orders, which is that soldiers who were planning to leave the military, not only soldiers but Marines and airmen and the sailors as well, who had planned to leave the military, they're literally stopped from leaving and they have to remain in the service indefinitely.
Mark Mazzetti, many thanks for being with us.
Thanks very much.
And Mark Mazzetti is defense correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. He spoke to us from Washington. Rocking in the Free World, Neil Young's classic rock anthem and the song Michael Moore uses to close his controversial new movie, Fahrenheit 9/11. It was the number one movie in America this past weekend, posting record-breaking ticket sales of $21.8 million. The highest ever for a documentary, the film drew howls of laughter and howls of protest from packed theaters around the country, due in part to scenes like this.
With everything going wrong, he did what any of us would do. He went on vacation.
We must stop the terror. I call upon all nations to do everything they can to stop these terrorist killers.
Thank you.
Now watch this drive.
Well, it's typical Michael Moore, ironic humor from a self-described iconoclastic working-class crusader. But his crusade this time against President Bush, against the Iraq War, has fired up both supporters and critics. Thought-provoking, sensational, will really energize conversation, says one more proponent. To describe this film as dishonest and demagogic would almost be to promote those terms to the level of respectability, says a detractor. But is this film pure polemic and propaganda, or a high-profile movie that speaks truth to power? Tonight on Point, The Facts and the Fury over Fahrenheit 9/11. Did you see Fahrenheit 9/11? What did you make of it? Is it a fair reporting of the facts or political propaganda? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us now from New York is David Edelstein, film critic for Slate.com and Public Radio's Fresh Air. Welcome, David Edelstein.
Thank you.
Also with us in New York, Matthew Continetti, reporter for the Weekly Standard. Welcome to you.
Thank you.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, our own Jack Beattie, On Point News Analyst. Welcome, Jack.
Hello to you, Julian. Hello to our guests.
David Edelstein, you've said that in 20 years of writing about film, no movie has ever tied you up in knots the way Michael Moore's Fahrenheit 9/11 has. Why is that?
Well, you said it was controversial. It was controversial within me. I mean, part of me, I have to say, I came of age with Jimmy Carter and Mike Dukakis and Walter Mondale, and I think people that I would call very respectfully mealy-mouthed liberals. And, you know, all that time, I was wishing, as I would hear Rush Limbaugh and I would see the Lee Atwater campaigns against people whose politics I cared about, all the time I was wishing fervently for a blowhard that the left could call its own. You know, someone who would sort of bring back this rabid prankster spirit. And along comes Michael Moore, you know, and a friend said to me, be careful what you wish for. I don't necessarily respect all of Mr. Moore's techniques. I do find it demagogic. I think the movie's full of cheap shots. I think there are some elisions, is that the right word, in the chain of events. All the same, you know, part of me, very down deep, just thrills to see this to see people sort of come together in a theater and watch this, you know, spectacular act of insolence. I mean, I called it the liberal's passion of the Christ.
Matthew Continetti, you're sitting next to David Edelstein there in our New York studio. Did you come to blows before the show came on air?
No, not at all. We were having a very nice conversation. I saw the film last weekend in a packed, sold-out theater in suburban Virginia, definitely red state America. And as propaganda, I found it extremely successful. The entire theater was erupting into cheers and applause throughout the film, especially at the close.
And that was in Red State America.
Yeah, it was. And Moore, over the weekend, responding to the box office success, pointed out that he found, and I don't know whether this is just a typical Moore kind of hyperbolic statement or not, but he did say that his research or whoever his sources were throughout the country showed that it was playing well throughout the nation. And to be the number one film in America, it does have to play well throughout America.
But what did you yourself think of the film?
Well, like I said, I thought it was propaganda. I did think it was very successful propaganda. And I found it interesting that this is probably the most overtly political of Moore's films. His other two, Bowling for Columbine and Roger and Me, his first one, kind of took on the system as a whole. I mean, sure, there were kind of nemeses in both films. And Roger and Me, you had, of course, the chair of General Motors, Bowling for Columbine. You had this very kind of disturbing encounter between Moore and Charlton Heston. But this is just – it's a two-hour onslaught against the current occupant of the White House, and it's unending.
Jack, let's bring in Jack Beatty. And, Jack, rather like David Edelstein, this film, Fahrenheit 9/11, left you, I don't know, with sort of rather mixed feelings?
Less mixed as time goes by. I mean, I was greatly reassured when 2 weeks ago Philip Shenon in the New York Times, who covered the 9/11 hearings for the Times, said, and I quote, "It's safe to say that the central assertions of fact in this film are supported by the public record. Indeed, many of them will be familiar to those who followed Mr. Bush's career." Well, that reassured me, as did the statements that he had a fact checker, that he hired a lawyer, because his earlier films had really sometimes played fast and loose with the fabric of history, with the actual things. But what I think bothers people in this, I mean, conservatives, is reality. Sure, he arranges reality, but he didn't arrange. I mean, he's revealing. He's not making Bush look inept in that scene in Florida. There's a scene where he gets the news that the second plane has hit the second tower, and this is an unprecedented situation. And he sits there for 7 minutes reading silently, I guess, a children's book. He's not reacting and looking for all the world like a lost sheep. Now, does that make him look inept, or does that rather expose his incapacity? It seems to me it does the latter, and that the quarrel with the propaganda charge is about lying. I don't see lying here. What I see is satirical intent and political argument done in the way that a movie person does.
David Edelstein, Jack Beatty there described this as satire. So maybe the label documentary doesn't fit Fahrenheit 9/11.
Yeah, I would agree. Well, documentary is a very broad, is a very elastic term. But I think that, you know, some of my friends, my liberal friends who have objected to the film, have a much more, they have a very idealized view of documentary as something where the filmmaker comes in and turns on the camera and doesn't really know what he or she is going to get, and molds the film based on the footage. It's very clear that Moore has put together this sort of ridiculing collage. But I think, you know, I don't have any problem with political propaganda as long as it doesn't lie. And I think, and I agree with Jack that I think, you know, at least 95% of this film, if not more, is actually much closer to the public record. The public record, not even anything Moore went out and, you know, and found and dug up himself, than anything that he's done in the past.
Matthew Continetti, were you uncomfortable with the images, with the kinds of ways in which the images were used in the film?
Well, I mean, they're grisly images, especially those of the Iraqi civilians who were victims of the war. But I guess what I objected to most in that case was just these images were shorn of all context. Moore shows pre-war Iraq, Saddam Hussein's Iraq, as my colleague Matt Labesh put it, as a setting for a Valtrex commercial. It's a tranquil, placid land where children are flying kites. And of course, I'm sure kids did fly kites in Iraq when Saddam ruled, but there were also hundreds of thousands of people being massed murdered. It was a highly totalitarian state. Moore doesn't acknowledge any of that. What's more, he also says at one point that Saddam, who posed no threat to anyone, which of course you can disagree with or not, he also says that Saddam had never murdered any Americans. Now, I think that's an interesting sentence to parse because, of course, Saddam had killed many Americans in the first Gulf War. He attempted to assassinate Bush's father in 1993. He held American prisoners of war from the first Gulf War and then, you know, those during the second before the regime was toppled. Everything Moore says, I think, is probably closely read true, but there's always the overarching lie, as in all propaganda.
Matthew Continetti, do stay with us. And you too, Jack Beatty and David Edelstein. We're talking about Michael Moore's new movie, Fahrenheit 9/11. Have you seen it? Is it a documentary, a satire, or both? Can or will the movie have an effect on the upcoming election? Did Fahrenheit 9/11 have an effect on you? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Julian Marshall, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Julian Marshall. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Michael Moore's new movie, Fahrenheit 9/11. Here's a scene from the film where Michael Moore is talking with Craig Unger, author of the book House of Bush, House of Saud. They're standing in front of the Saudi embassy in Washington and attract the attention of the United States Secret Service.
The embassy of Saudi Arabia. How much money do the Saudis have invested in America, roughly?
I've heard figures as high as $860 billion.
What percentage of our economy does that represent? I mean, it seems like a lot.
It's roughly 6 or 7% of America.
Mr. Marcus, could you promote, please, sir?
Yeah, sure.
How are you doing?
Yeah, good. How are you doing?
Good. Steve Kim with Secret Service. How are you doing,
sir? Yes.
We're just ascertaining information regarding... Are you doing a documentary regarding the Saudi Arabia embassy?
Yes. Even though we were nowhere near the White House, for some reason the Secret Service had shown up to ask us what we were doing standing across the street from the Saudi embassy.
I didn't realize the Secret Service guards foreign embassies.
Not usually, no, sir.
No. Did they give you any trouble, Saudis?
No comment on that, sir.
Well, I'll take that as a yes.
A scene from Michael Moore's new film, Fahrenheit 9/11. So what do you make of the movie? Is it fact or fiction? Do you think it's acceptable to bend fact to make a political point? Or does Michael Moore's argument ring true to you? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined from New York by David Edelstein, film critic for Slate.com and Fresh Air, and by Matthew Continetti, reporter for the Weekly Standard. Also with us is On Point's news analyst Jack Beatty. And on the line, Carl, calling from Suttons Bay, Michigan. He saw the film. Carl, what did you make of it?
Well, I was not really all that surprised by the content. I mean, a lot of what was presented in the film was things that I had already at least heard about in passing at various points. And what really surprised me was the breadth of people that were in the audience at the film. I mean, we ended up going and seeing it in Traverse City, Michigan on Sunday night. And even then, we still had to get our tickets like 2 hours in advance to go to see the film. And before the film started, we were out walking around and we had noticed a lot of VFW hats and a couple of American Legion hats and things like that in the audience, and we're just amazed by that, and we didn't hear a single negative during the film, at least.
But what about yourself? What about you yourself, Carl? Did you feel that Michael Moore was playing it straight?
I think he may have been playing fast and loose with some of the facts, but for the most part, he presented it well. I think he kind of played around with them a little bit just to kind of enhance some sort of either dramatic or comedic effect, maybe. But for the most part, I think his information, according to what I had read about the individual incidents in the past, were dead on.
So you didn't feel as if you were being taken for a ride?
Not really, no. Like I said, most of what was presented were things that had already been in the press.
Okay, let's hear from Steve in Oshkosh, Wisconsin. Steve?
Good evening. Thanks. I saw the film in Appleton, Wisconsin on opening night. And, you know, what strikes me about Michael Moore is I think he's the loudest voice who takes issue with American exceptionalism. And I wonder if it isn't, at least in part, his Catholicism that says whether it's somebody leaping out of a building on September 11th or an American soldier from Flint or a 10-year-old boy in Baghdad, they are equally worthy human beings. And that can be a hard message to swallow for a lot of Americans.
Matthew Continetti, your response to that? Catholicism and exceptionalism, were you picking up on that in Fahrenheit 9/11?
Well, it's interesting that the caller mentioned people leaping from buildings. We actually don't see any of that footage, and I thought it was a fascinating omission. Though we do see all of the tragedies of the civilian casualties in Iraq and, of course, the United States soldiers who are mutilated or shot, we never once see the Twin Towers. Moore chooses to black out the part of the movie when the terrorists struck on September 11th. I think that's a very important omission because you can't really understand or come to grips with the Bush administration's foreign policy without recognizing just the world-changing nature of that event.
David Edelstein, valid criticism that Michael Moore's selectivity with the facts.
Yeah, I mean, I actually find myself agreeing with Matthew on a lot of these points. The scene that he mentioned earlier in Baghdad, before the bombings, is really straight out of Apocalypse Now, where you get an establishing shot of a very peaceful Vietnamese village That's followed by the famous raid in which the Ride of the Valkyries is played. And similarly, in Moore's film, he goes right to a discussion of soldiers saying that they like to plug their iPods into their tank speakers so they can really rock out when they're killing people. And then that's followed by those grisly and horrible shots of the civilian casualties. I also want to say that I kind of fell for one of Moore's distortions, the scene in which you played, in which the Secret Service approaches him outside the Saudi embassy. In fact, it is, I believe me, hundreds of readers have let me know that, in fact, it is part of the Secret Service's mandate to protect foreign diplomats. Now, as far as I can tell, it may be that Saudi Arabia has more than its share of Secret Service agents, and I don't think it was particularly wise of Prince Bandar or whomever dispatched those guys to walk up to Michael Moore. He obviously wasn't a terrorist, and they were kind of giving him a great gift there. But I don't think Moore gives us the whole truth in that instance. I also want to say that, I've gotten hundreds and hundreds of emails, and they divide roughly about three ways from my very kind of painfully ambivalent review. One third says, thank you for articulating my mixed feelings. The other third says, you pinko commie wussy, you're a traitor to this country, all liberals are the same. And the last third says, how dare you say anything about Michael Moore, this great hero, this man who alone is standing up when the network media, the mainstream media has just fallen in line behind the Bush administration. How dare you attack this American hero? I don't know what that all means, except that we remain deeply divided.
Jack Beattie, do you think there is a point there that an awful lot of moviegoers might forgive Michael Moore because of what they feel is the need for counter-propaganda, if you like, at the moment?
Well, I resist counter. I resist propaganda.
Right.
So, political argument, yes. I'm for calling it that. Steve raised an important point that Michael Moore doesn't buy American exceptionalism. I think that's very true. He looks at America. He doesn't look at America and see the official story. He looks from the ground up. He looks from Flint up. And he sees a lot of broken promises to a lot of vulnerable people. And that's his general take on things. He's unillusioned, and maybe you can take that too far. He's cynical about the country, but almost blithely so. But you don't run into that in these days of patriotic, and of course we stand by our troops and all this self flattery that people engage in, and patriotic solidarity. And so there is a kind of breath of fresh air here. Here's a guy who looks at America sort of from the point of view of its victims.
Let's bring into the conversation Michael Isikoff, investigative correspondent for Newsweek. He joins us from Silver Spring, Maryland. Michael, you've been following the events leading up to 9/11 and indeed since then, and the invasion of Iraq. How does Michael Moore's film square up to the facts as you understand them, as you know them, as you've established them?
Well, he's covering a very broad canvas, and there's a lot of ground to cover. Look, I think it's a very powerful movie. I think there's some really gripping footage in there. I was struck most particularly by the footage of which I'd never seen before in its entirety. President Bush at the school in Florida when he learns the second attack on the Trade Center, and certainly the whole latter part of the movie about the war in Iraq is not a matter of facts. It's a matter of obviously selecting some very powerful images and this poignant story of the woman who loses her son in Iraq. That said, in between, stitched through are a lot of conspiracy theories, a lot of speculative stuff, a lot of aspects of this that are just sort of thrown out in a somewhat disingenuous way that doesn't really measure up to anything approaching journalism.
I mean, there is one suggestion in the film that the Bush administration sent far too few ground troops to Afghanistan and thus allowed far too many Taliban and al-Qaeda members to escape. True or false?
Well, I mean, I don't know that that's a matter of true or false. That's certainly an argument that has been made. There have been, military people who have suggested that
We blew it in Afghanistan, especially in the Battle of Tora Bora, when we used Afghan proxies instead of going in ourselves. And perhaps the fact that we didn't have more troops there may have been a factor in that. But I don't see that as something that's worth true squatting. I mean, that's a matter of opinion, and it's certainly a legitimate opinion. They're far more insidious stuff in the movie. The whole treatment of the Saudi flights, for instance, is, I believe, somewhat dishonestly presented. We as has been amply documented elsewhere, the 9/11 Commission has looked into this matter and has presented the facts far differently than are presented in the movie. The suggestion that they were allowed, that the Saudis were allowed to depart the country at a time nobody else was allowed to fly, and that they weren't interviewed by the FBI, is belied by the findings of the 9/11 Commission, which says that many of the Saudis were interviewed. Many were asked detailed questions. I think that's an exact quote from the 9/11 Commission. And that the FBI took other steps to screen them, including checking them off of a variety of federal databases. And most importantly, the whole it's stated explicitly the White House approved these flights, and the suggestion is that the White House, tainted by its by Saudi oil money, kowtowed to the Saudis because of the connection with the Bush family, is totally belied by the fact that we know who at the White House approved these flights, and it was Richard Clark, the counterterrorism czar, a holdover from Bill Clinton's administration. So the suggestion that there was something sort of untoward here because of the Bush family's financial connection with the Saudis, which is a principal theme of the movie, just doesn't square up with the facts.
Let's take a call from Wahab in New York City. Wahab, have you seen the film?
No, I haven't seen the film. And that's, I think, the point that I'm going to try to make. What is a movie supposed to do? It's supposed to raise your consciousness, I guess, this type of movie. It's supposed to raise your consciousness and focus on the issues. Michael Moore has done that. I am going to see the film. I have every intent of seeing the film as soon as I can. The facts have been portrayed before us, and everyone there on the panel seems to have agreed that 95% of what has been said is fact, public fact. So, okay, what Michael Moore has done is arranged facts played before us in a venue that most of us can understand and watch comfortably. And now he gives us a chance to look at that and then make choices for what's going on in the future.
Thanks for that, Wahab. Let's hear from Azar, calling from Dracut, Massachusetts.
Hello.
Hi, what did you want to say?
Hi, I just wanted to say my husband and I went to see the movie a few nights ago, and ever since we've seen it, we've just talked to different people about it, and a lot of people, not a lot, but some people will be like, oh, I would never see that, like he fabricated this, and he twisted a lot of information. And I just wanted to say, for me, some of the most gripping scenes was not of Michael Moore talking, it was George Bush talking, and it was footage. I mean, unless he used some kind of special effects and voiceovers, I mean, there's no way he fabricated that. And also just different scenes, like in Iraq, the interview with the woman, Lila, who lost her son. It was mostly, for me, it wasn't him talking. It was just stuff that he filmed. And I think it's great that someone like him is giving us a different point of view.
You heard Michael Isikoff earlier saying that Michael Moore just got some of this just plain wrong. That doesn't worry you.
No, it doesn't. I mean, I've read some of his books. I saw Bowling for Columbine. I visited his website, and I don't think he has any bad intentions. I think it's great that someone like him is giving us a different point of view than what we're seeing on the news. And I think it's almost annoying that you're seeing so many people criticize him for what he's doing, but it's just because it's different. It's not the same that they're hearing on the news every night. It's just, I think we need, as Americans and what's going on in our country, I think we need to see this film because it gives us that different view that you don't see on any station on TV.
Matthew Continetti, what does it tell us about the level of political debate currently in the United States that you can have so many people who will concede that, you know, maybe Michael Moore has played it a bit fast and loose with the facts, and yet they're still prepared to go along with it?
Well, I think the overriding question whenever we talk about more in politics is how this film is going to affect the election. The film is really so early that I doubt it will affect the general election. What I'm interested in is whether it will have any added bonus to the kind of the bounce that John Kerry will receive at the end of this month at the Democratic National Convention. I think if swing voters see this film, they're repulsed by the images, and they swallow Michael Moore's version not only of events but also his theory of America, then that may play to John Kerry's favor. At the same time, Democrats have to ask their question, how close do they want to be to Michael Moore? Moore closes the film by reading what he says is a quote from George Orwell. It's an extended passage. What he doesn't say is that it's from 1984, Orwell's Portrait of a Totalitarian State, except the totalitarian state that Moore is discussing is the United States. And I think that was a very – that's a keen insight into how Michael Moore views America. He sees this as an oligarchy repressing the lower classes and engaging in perpetual warfare just because they can. Is that what Democrats believe? I hope not.
Jack Beatty, I mean, how many Democrats, to use Matthew Continetti's words, do you see swallowing Michael Moore's view of the universe, and particularly the United States and George Bush and the war in Iraq?
Well, I think it's kind of catnip to partisan Democrats. I mean, there's just no question about it. You watch it and you want to, and you know, they're cheering. But this point about reading Orwell, obviously he doesn't intend that literally. You can't. That's just ridiculous. But the point about that passage was, if you can look at the United States today and not worry about a war that has no end, about a war that is affecting our domestic security and therefore makes us ready to sacrifice liberty for security, about a war that is involving us with terrorists around the world, and about a president and an administration that has a proclivity for keeping secrets and for keeping information away from the public. Boy, there's a lot there to find ominous sort of indications of Orwell's world, and indeed the Orwellian speak of this administration, No Child Left Behind, Clean Skies Act, all the rest of it. Boy, that's a kind of satiric truth he was giving there, not a literal statement about totalitarianism in America, but a kind of warning. This way lies tyranny.
Do stay with us, On Points news analyst Jack Beatty. You too, David Edelstein, film critic for Slate.com and Fresh Air. Matthew Continetti, reporter for the Weekly Standard. And Michael Isikoff, investigative correspondent for Newsweek. We're talking tonight about Fahrenheit 9/11. Are you fed up with Michael Moore and his style of political argument? Or do you see Michael Moore as a no-holds-barred political crusader? What does this movie tell you about the level of political debate in America today? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Julian Marshall. This is On Point. I'm Julian Marshall. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Michael Moore's new movie, Fahrenheit 9/11. Here's another scene from the film where Michael Moore tries to get members of Congress to enlist their children in the United States military.
Congressman, Michael Moore.
Hey, Michael. How are you doing?
Good. I'm good.
John Tanner.
Hey, nice to meet you. Nice to meet you.
You have kids?
Yeah.
Is there any way we can get them to enlist and go over there and help out with the effort? Congressman? Michael Moore.
Good.
Trying to get members of Congress to get their kids to enlist in the Army and go over to Iraq. Congressman Castle. Congressman Doolittle. Michael Moore. I'm wondering if...
Of course, not a single member of Congress wanted to sacrifice their child for the war in Iraq. And who could blame them? Who would want to give up their child? Would you?
Well, I'm joined tonight from New York by David Edelstein, film critic for Slate.com and NPR's Fresh Air. Also with us, Matthew Continetti, reporter for the Weekly Standard, and on the line from Silver Spring, Maryland, Michael Isikoff, investigative reporter for Newsweek, and Jack Peaty, On Point news analyst. Michael Isikoff, just a thought for you. You spend weeks, possibly months, trying to get it right in your reports, trying to get the facts right. Along comes Michael Moore, perhaps arguably blurring the fact, playing facts, playing loose and fast with them. What do you feel about that?
Well, I don't feel any special resentment of other than...
But he's making far greater impact, it would seem.
He's doing something very different than what I do, and you know, I would like to think there's some value in both. There's a couple of things that are sort of annoying to me as a journalist on this. I mean, obviously, I did one sort of very modest truth-squatting piece a week or so ago in Newsweek, and the Michael Moore people came back at me and tried to challenge some of what I had written. One of the problems here is there isn't a transcript of the movie. I've asked several times now, can we see a transcript of exactly what you're saying? Because one of the things they're doing to rebut some of the criticism is saying, oh, that's not exactly what we said. I'll give you one example. The movie at one point says something like $1.4 billion goes from Saudi interests to the Bush family. And then they actually throw in, and I didn't catch this the first time I saw the movie, and friends. Well, that and friends is quite a elastic term that's thrown in there, which allows them to throw when they compile this to throw a lot of stuff into this, how they came up with that figure, that doesn't really show any financial connection, or doesn't really show that there's $1.4 billion going to the Bush family or Bush family interests in any way. I mean, the friends allows them to throw in money that went to the Carlyle Group, for instance, or a Carlyle Group-owned company at a time when no member of the Bush family was affiliated with the Carlyle Group. So in that way, it's a bit dishonest, I think, or disingenuous, and you know, the lack of a transcript in which you can sort of pin them down on exactly what they're saying, I think allows them to sort of throw in a lot of innuendo and misleading passages that, as I said, I think is a little disingenuous.
Michael Isikoff, investigative correspondent for Newsweek. Thanks for being with us this hour. Let's go to Brandon, calling from Traverse City, Michigan. Brandon, what did you want to say?
A couple things. I just wanted to say, talking about innuendo, look at the coverage of 9/11 immediately after by the mainstream press. And, I think what Michael Moore does unintentionally, perhaps, is begs this question about subjectivity versus objectivity in journalism, or if you want to call it propaganda, I guess it doesn't really matter. But to a certain extent, all of it is an assembly of facts with some unifying concept. And the important thing is rigor. There was enough rigor. If the panel can agree that 95% of the facts were straight and 5% was perhaps innuendo, well, then that's just about as good as most of the coverage that you hear in most other sources. And I'd wonder what your panel might have to say about that.
Matthew Continetti.
Well, I think 95% was a generous number that was kind of thrown out there.
I'd say 94.
Yeah,
93. But close.
That's getting close to 100%, isn't it, Matthew Conte?
Well, there's that 7% is still a very wide margin. Look, what strikes me is, as Michael Isikoff suggested, is this is a whole public relations campaign. In fact, it's very reminiscent of a political campaign in that Michael Moore has not only Mario Cuomo, but also Democratic consultants Chris Lehane and Mark Fabiani working for him, putting anytime someone raises a factual issue with the film, these surrogates, just like in a presidential campaign, are out there. Michael Moore is very good at promoting himself. He's very good at promoting his work. That's what struck me about this whole debate. In some way, it only helps Michael Moore's financial interest.
Wait a minute. That's great that he has people out there, because that way if somebody tries to land a blow that isn't fair against him, these people can come right back at it. Yeah, sure, it's like a war room. It's like a campaign war room. I don't think there's anything wrong with that, given how incredibly divisive that this film is. I want to actually say something about what Michael Isikoff said. I'm sorry he's not here. He talks about the stitching together some kind of vast conspiracy theory. I think the remarkable thing about the film is it doesn't really hang together. I mean, I think Moore is content just to throw a lot of stuff on the wall and see what sticks. And it's a lot of stuff that many of us know, having read books like House of Bush, House of Sod, but it's not a lot of stuff that other people know. Mostly, his most effective propaganda tool, are just those sort of images of our president. I mean, I think all but the most rabid partisan, is going to be astonished by what our president often appears like. You know, this combination of sort of smugness and vacuity. I mean, he's an extraordinarily potent object for the prosecution.
Okay. Let's take a call from Bob in Mount Olive, New Jersey. Bob, have you seen the film?
No, I haven't, and I don't intend to.
Why is that?
Because I don't need to see the left-wing propaganda. But I did want to comment on the clip that you played earlier with Michael Moore disingenuously going to people and asking if they want to send their children to die in Iraq.
Yeah.
Nobody wants to send their children to die in any war. And I put to the audience that if Michael Moore were walking around in the 1940s asking Americans if they wanted to send their children to die in Europe, well, many of them, I mean, who's going to say yes to that question? Nobody wants their children to die. The people in Iraq today volunteered to go there, and it's their job. But some things in this world are worth fighting for and indeed worth dying for. And if you want to be Michael Moore or the left wing of this party, to the audience listening today, I say to all of them that if you're not going to stand up and fight for what's right and believe in your country, then what is worth fighting for? We don't want to fight in Iraq. We don't want to fight this global war on terror because it's Orwellian and it's a conspiracy just to keep the war going. Well, okay, let's not fight it. We'll tell Al Qaeda we don't want to play, and they're going to just leave us alone.
Okay,
it's
Bob,
not going to work that way.
Bob, thanks for that. Jack Beattie, if I can come back to you and just raise again that issue of the level of political debate in this country. And you heard Bob there speaking in a very impassioned manner. There seems to be this intense polarization, and you have to make a film like Michael Moore's Fahrenheit 9/11 to be heard.
Yes, I mean, you have to shout to be heard, and you have to do something on a mass basis, which he's done, and you have to be a brilliant businessman, which he is, and you have to have even more brilliant businessmen, as he does, pushing you. But, you know, Bob makes a really good point. We have real enemies. That's not in question. But I think the issue, and Michael Moore didn't say to die in Iraq. He said go to fight in Iraq, and that really raises a question. The elite in this country, as represented by the congressman, the distance between them and the people in the army is immense. They have no connections. In World War II, by contrast, when there was a draft, it was a people's war. Everybody was involved. The elite, too. William F. Buckley was in the trenches. This is a different story. We have this volunteer army, which comes from places like Flint, and we see the recruiters out there, you know, almost like pimps grabbing the kids as they come into the mall, and it's the poor mall. That's the truth, and we have this vast social, you know, gulf in the country, and those of us who would like to see a draft come back want it precisely because it would be a break on this kind of foreign adventurism. If the kids of the elite, William Crystal's kids and Charles Krauthammer's and that congressman's were going to Iraq, there wouldn't have been an Iraq war.
Let's hear from Jack calling from Duluth, Minnesota. Jack?
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. It was a great conversation. I saw the movie, and first of all, I don't care what spectrum you come from, it was a tour de force, really great piece of work on its own. Secondly, I just felt devastated after I saw it. But the point I want to make is, what was Moore's purpose and who were his audience? I guess I don't know who the audience was except the American public, but the purpose was, I don't think, to answer questions. I think the purpose was to raise questions. I came away wondering, What is the relationship between the Bush administration and the Saudis? What's the relationship between the Bush administration and oil? And what happened in 2000 in the election? So I didn't really get answers. Sure, I saw a bumbling president that troubled me very much, especially after the planes hit, chewing his lip in the classroom. I guess that was a question that was raised, too. Why
Jack, can I just ask you, is this film likely to affect the way you vote in November?
No, I don't think so. I just feel like, for me, it just made me want to go find out some answers to some pretty important questions.
Matthew Continetti, that's got to be a good thing. If it's a documentary like this has got people asking questions, even though maybe, in your opinion, they're the wrong kind of questions.
Well, I think the ties between the Bush family and the Saudi Arabian royal family are fascinating and are worthy of discussion. And it's funny the caller mentioned that segment of the film in particular because my companion at the movie, who's not, you know, a political elite, not a member of the elite, or not necessarily even following the day-to-day events, but still a somewhat supporter of the action in Iraq, came away from the movie almost obsessed with those types of ties. I think that would provide a very potent campaign issue for the Kerry campaign, highlighting kind of the swaddling treatment we give the Saudis, which I and my magazine is very much opposed to.
Yeah, I was wondering whose side you're on here. I mean, but look, here's another thing. I mean, the issue here is that one of the reasons that the film, you know, has touched this chord is that we have a president here who won't speak to those issues. I mean, like him or hate him, he is the most insulated president in modern American history. And the fact that Michael Moore can come along and have the number one movie in the country throwing this stuff out there, you know, it is received by people who are desperate to see our president, you know, go in front of the American people and actually answer unscripted questions and allow follow-up questions. I mean, it's just you can understand this kind of cathartic effect that the movie is having for people who really want to see this.
Jack Beattie,
maybe now he'll deal with it.
Jack Beattie, I mean, that's a word I've heard on more than one occasion in connection with this film and those who go to see 9/11, Fahrenheit 9/11. Catharsis.
Yes, I mean, I think for Democrats, it's been building since Florida. And by the way, I think Moore does get it wrong there. He says every analysis says that Gore would have taken Florida. Hardly. Some analyses do. It's a letting out of all the pent up steam. And of course, Democrats have felt, and critics of this war, that the media has been in a somnolent trance. That they have until very recently, and that this is the first sort of media-like thing. You know, it's not just something you read in The Nation. There it is on film. Lots of people are seeing it. It's a collective experience, and by God, it isn't. It doesn't partake of the somnolence. It seems to be made by somebody who's just up to reality.
Jack Beattie, On Point news analyst. Many thanks for being with us, and my thanks to you too, David Edelstein, film critic for Slate.com and NPR's Fresh Air, and Matthew Continetti, reporter for The Weekly Standard. Continue the conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Julie Jopp, Eileen Imada, Jane Manners, Tamar Morad, Chris O'Connor, John Roberts, James Ross, and Karen Schiffman, with help from Michael Garth and Cora Peterson. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Julian Marshall, standing in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.